Mr. Jerome Pezzenti, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Now, thank you for making the time for being here with us today. You have extensive experience in AI, having worked as vice president of the Watson core technology at IBM, later the Watson platform, at Benevolent AI, which applies AI to drug discovery, and that you worked as CEO and board member, and also at Meta as vice president of AI, which in on itself would just be enough for us to have many multiple hours long episodes to talk about. And that's not even mentioning what we're actually here to talk about, which is your new company, Sizzle AI, which has been employing generative AI in the education sector with personalized smart tutors. So we're definitely going to talk about that. But of course, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you to talk a little bit about this incredible journey that brought you here, which happened during one of the most exciting times ever to work on AI, which is right now, right? So how was it like to not just see, but lead these changes on a daily basis from within the companies making the biggest changes and moves in the AI sector?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've been in this space for a long time, so I came to it because I wanted to understand the brain, you know. And so I came to do some research at Carnegie Mellon in 1998. And then from there, I decided to start a company, you know, in 2000 in AI. And that was the start of my journey. So, you know, I think people forget that AI has been around for a very long time. You know, it existed before I was born. You know, the term was coined after the war. And there have been people who have done AI even longer than I have. You know, like, I'm happy to discuss any part of the journey. But yes, it has been a long journey and has been fun.
The advantage of having spent a quarter century, sorry, on this, is that you surely developed a bit of... Yeah, I'm sorry about that. You surely developed a bit of extra perspective compared to anybody who's just getting into it. So from your standpoint, how do you compare the evolution, the excitement, the interest in AI currently against other times with other breakthroughs like GANs in the 2010s, deep learning before that, machine learning with SVMs in the 90s and so on? What's different now? And better yet, is it different now or are we just caught up in the moment?
It's a good question. And I think it's a difference not in nature, but in size. And it's what's pretty remarkable. And I feel like even though I've been in the space for 25 years, I am still amazed, you know. And it's kind of interesting that the amazements become bigger, not smaller, which, you know, I'm more of a skeptical person. So I would say usually it doesn't happen this way, you know. Okay, but so that's what's remarkable. Progress has been strong, you know, in the past 25 years, you know, progress has been stronger in the past 12 years, stronger even more in the past 5 years, and progress has been even stronger in the past 2 years. So it gives a sense of bit of acceleration. The flip side of that is there's always the constant is overhyped. Everything is overhyped. You know, it's a lot further from being applied than people think. I think people always look at the core capability being priced, but applying this technology is hard. You know, it's difficult. It takes understanding of the user. It takes understanding the limitation of the technology. So I think people are always ahead of themselves. That's a constant. But it's true that it's making remarkable progress.
Mr. Pezzenti, I'd like to ask you, this moment that we're seeing right now, this engine, of course, started to move in the 50s, like you mentioned. But if we want to talk about the more recent times, it really started to move in 2017, more or less, when the paper about the transformers came out. And also when we had more computational power, GPUs and all that. And during this time, you were working at Meta, not at 2017, but after 2018. And Meta is one of the companies that is really leading this race right now. And you were there for quite some time. So talking about this time when you were there, how did you deal with this progress? Like, did you have your eyes at what it could be in the future, like GPT, Llama project? Because when you talk about GPT, this whole disruption came about in November 2022, but other models like GPT-3, GPT-2, they came much before that. So how was your view about this being in the market?
So I think you need to get a little bit of context. This is why sometimes I think people see the most recent. So, you know, there was a question that was asked to Mark recently as to, hey, why did you decide to invest in so many GPUs? Okay, the backstory there is that basically 3 years ago, Mark realized, and obviously that was, you know, in many ways thanks to my team, you know, like that the ROI on AI was already amazing. Okay, and I can tell you, but it had nothing to do with GPT at the time. You have to realize that some companies like Meta or Google have made tens of billions of dollars. You know, I'm not talking, this is like really big numbers, thanks to optimization that come from AI, in particular ads. Okay. So AI, you know, this system that learn from data have been put in practice in these companies with amazing results to make, I mean, one of the use cases to make ads that are a lot more compelling, a lot more relevant to you by mining all the behaviors people can debate. So there was already really major awareness that what it could do. Another effort that was at Meta, and I think you mentioned that actually in the podcast, is, you know, doing competing against TikTok, you know, and TikTok, the key was to create something that really can understand you and really quickly. And we needed Reels to do the same thing. And we needed models that were much bigger than what we had in the past. So this, you know, use of deep learning and of this very large model of computational power for it, that was actually happening before. And especially, I would say, like Google and Meta being the two, with ROIs, you know, they're not negligible. You're talking tens of billions of dollars and key part of the business there. So I think this was there. What was interesting with GPT and this language model was it's an interaction that anybody can understand. You know, people don't quite understand that there is AI behind the system when you're on Instagram or when you're looking at ads. But in GPT, you really have an understanding. Now, what was very interesting, and you asked me about this, is that when I was there in 2020, we had one of the best chatbots at the time, you know, like, and I was promoting, I have posted internally where I was saying, this thing is amazing. Look what it's doing. I couldn't convince anybody that it was the future. You kidding me? Kid me not. I had project and people would say, text and interaction. I'm not going to say names, but people were very high there. They didn't believe it was the future. And I'm like, and to be honest, by the time I left, I was like, maybe they were right. You know, I don't know, you know, and then this ChatGPT happened. Obviously ChatGPT did something better, you know, it pushed, but it's the same technology. We had these language models. It was called BlenderBot. You can check it out. You know, like it was the best bot out there for a few years. It was not as good as GPT. This is what, at some point, there was a moment where people saw new things it could do, but it was the same technology, just scaled up, you know.
Right. And last question about the before times, I promise. Could you talk a little bit about the process of committing that led Meta to commit all in to open source when it comes to the whole part of research of the models that we're seeing and everything? Of course, this is not an overnight thing, right? Meta had been preparing for it way before it blew up. But what was it like to commit and lead maybe the decision to commit to open source and have it throughout the years?
Yeah, I think there's really interesting history there. And I would say I was a very strong, actually, proponent and defender. But the history is even before, you know, in some way, Facebook, I think the engineering team there had always propensity to open source. You know, there was the Open Compute, there was React. So I think it was in the DNA. Jan LeCun, when he joined and created the research team there, which I ended up inheriting when there, also had this strong proponent of open science. You know, when I went there, you know, I scaled the team pretty big, almost like 10x, you know, like huge investment. And I was still like a huge proponent of open source. And my boss, who was a CTO, you know, Stripe, was also a proponent. But then, you know, I pushed the boundary, we did PyTorch, we went all in. And I was really like always saying, by default, we will open source the models, right? So I kind of like supported that vision. And I think when I left, actually, I even texted Mark and I said, this Llama thing, you got to let people use it for commercial. You know, I don't know if I changed his mind, but I did push him, like, you know, even after I left, to say, like, you got to open it up. It's an amazing opportunity. And I think what the angle which I had when I was thinking, like, is like, this is going to be our angle into AI. You know, other people will want to, you know, make money on it. The change we have at Meta is we use it, but we don't want to make money on it. And that gives us a lot of freedom to do things that are different from others. So we don't compete and again the same thing. So I would say it was a long process, and I think it has a good rationale, and it allows Meta to have a bit of a different angle, you know. And I'm really glad that right now it was starting to come out when I was there, but I was like, oh my God, the message, you know, and it was kind of cool to see with Llama being now feeling people say, oh yeah, but it was there before I was there. I was a huge proponent of it, and I think we made a lot of progress. And now I think it's coming out to the, you know, people realizing it, you know, the common consciousness finally, you know, catch up with it.
Fantastic. Mr. Pesenti, now going to the present, we're finally talking about CISO, which is your new company, which you call basically a learning buddy, right? So I'd like to ask about your inspirations when you decided to create this company, because we know like education is the way to the future, basically the way to spread the knowledge to all the people around the world. And using technology to do this is an amazing way to perform this quest, let's say. So my question here is about your inspiration. Because when we look at it, you can see maybe some traces of some other things that were in the market, like Wolfram Alpha, Brilliant, Coursera maybe. So I'd like to ask your opinion about this.
I mean, what drew me to it actually is a bit of a bigger story, is that I felt like, you know, I've been in AI for a long time, and I see the progress and the power that comes with it, not just with GPT recently, but as I mentioned, for example, this system, this recommender system that keeps you coming back, that keeps you buying, that keeps you using systems like, you know, TikTok or Reels. And for me, I was like, how do you put all that power in a way, I mean, how you use it in a way that's more aligned with the user? Like, how do you do something for them that when they interact with it, they feel really good about it? And that's something I tried to do at Meta, but I don't think I really made a change, which was like, hey, can we make Instagram feel like when you use it at the end, you feel really good about it, or you feel like you've learned something? You know, it's difficult to do that in a company that ultimately is trying to optimize for engagement. I think that's what I found when I was there. And I'm like, okay, then let me build it outside, and let me build something that leverage all that power, you know, to create something that gets value for you, you know. And I think learning, being more knowledgeable about things is a big value. And people will be really, you know, happy to get a system that keeps them engaged to learn.
Right. And you started, actually, you announced, I'm not sure, Sizzle AI early last year, right? January 2023. You had a vision for the contribution you could make to the learning experience, given the potential of Gen AI, right? Now that you're almost a year and a half in, how has it been? What has this journey been like? And are you where you wanted to go? Or is it one of these things that you sort of deviate from the path and you find out that there's an even bigger objective or contribution you can make?
No, I think we still have the same vision, and I'm more convinced than ever that it's going to happen. And we are making progress along it. So we have an app that has hundreds of thousands of active users. You know, so people use it every day. They help it when they're stuck. They need a buddy, I just say, you know, to help you. And we're starting to deliver more value through the app. So we launched what we call like a learning feed, where you can tell it, I want to learn X, and it's going to give you an experience that feels a bit like Duolingo, but for any kind of like topic. So we're starting to show like, oh, what can like a personalized feed-like experience for learning look like, you know, that feels more engaging. So that's where we're going. We're doing one step at a time. It is a complicated field in terms of like, there's not a lot of success in that field. You know, this is what's the challenge. If you're a VC or investor, you look at that, you're like, there's Duolingo, you know, but it's pretty much it. You know, there's one company out there. So everybody's convinced it's going to happen, but everybody's like, well, how? I'm not sure. You know, like there's not a lot of success. So, and I knew that before I joined the field, which is it's a challenging field in terms of who has been involved, how much appetite there is for innovation there. But that's what I want to do right now. I want to do something big, and I want to bring like complete innovation to that field. And I think I'm more convinced than ever that the vision is the right one, and it's possible to make it happen right now. But it is also a challenging environment, I would say, from an investment perspective, from a, you know, like convincing the user as well, you know, so it'll be interesting to see where it goes.
And I'd like to ask you about the architecture of the system, only while you can review to us, of course, but I've read that you use a multitude of AI tools on the back. So GPT-3, Llama and others. Is it true? And do you prefer to use the private ones like GPT, Gemini, or are you using the open source ones like Llama 3 that was just released, Gemma and so on? And also, how do you make sure that the questions being asked are correct? Because hallucination can be a big problem here, right?
All right, two questions. So the first one is, we started using OpenAI at the start. That's the easiest thing you can do. And now we use a multiplicity of models. So we actually are, you know, looking at Mixtral, the largest one, where Llama 3 is definitely in our arsenal, and we use fine-tuning as well. So we kind of like use, we have a four-prong approach right now, GPT-4, GPT-3 fine-tune, Llama 3, and Mixtral. And then trying to use the best model for the task, especially after fine-tuning, is what we're trying to optimize for right now. And all these models have trade-offs between their size, their cost, their latency, and you need to kind of like, nothing is perfect, because the perfect will be like the most accuracy, very cheap, very fast, you know, and it doesn't exist today. So you need to complement. And plus, on top of that, you have a lot of like other more traditional ML tasks that you don't need to use these models for. You still need to do, you know, classification, like is there an image, is there a diagram in what the problem is solved. So you know, we're very pragmatic ML practitioners right now and try to use the best model for the tool. And it's moving quickly, so it's kind of difficult. So we have our own internal benchmark, we've tried a lot of things, and we try to adapt quickly to the environment. You know, very interesting time. On the second one, yes, these models make mistakes. That's part of designing a product around it. That's what's interesting, is that, yes, they make mistakes. Sometimes you can catch some of these mistakes if you have more time. But it's also, again, like a trade-off between accuracy, latency, and part of that is the user. You need to make them aware that, hey, it's a learning buddy. You know, as you say, it's not a teacher here. So it will make mistake, right? And you need to be aware of that. But, you know, finding the mistake is also part of learning. And so people do find, what was interesting for us is that, you know, we put it out there and people find that useful. So, you know, we have a lot of users and they know it makes mistakes at times. They need to be aware of that. But it's still useful, because it's better to have someone that gives you ideas and helps you, and then nobody. You know? Now, it's still, you know, a big concern. We'd love to have a system that doesn't make any mistake. And I think in learning, there is more chance to get there, because learning is more, you know, like a contained space. So our view is, how can we really understand this contained space and make it so that we can make as few mistakes as possible?
Right. And walking right into that, there are two, I don't want to say, there are two complementary sides to the experience or to the technology that you're proposing, right? There's the teaching part and the learning part, right? And the learning part, you have the tutor adapting to the students, to the wiring in their brain so they can better learn something. But my impression is that one might have to actually adapt the way that one teaches in order to may take full advantage of the Gen AI, which is sort of at odds with the traditional way of teaching. So what sort of adjustments do you see that are necessary in the educational market in order for Gen AI to actually become this, realize the full potential of teaching?
Yeah, so for us, this is really like the key thesis behind Sizzle, is like, we want to learn what's the best way to teach, if you want, you know, or even to tutor or to help someone. So my only claim to fame in this, I have four kids, and I don't think they think I'm a very good tutor, okay? Like, I do my best. I spend a lot of time with them, but they would say, I'm sure, that I'm kind of like a mediocre and I don't have much empathy. So the problem is that, you know, nobody knows, you know, what's the best way to do these things. And what we'd love to do with Sizzle is put a flywheel together so that we learn, you know, like we see how people interact with that content. With Gen AI, the nice thing is we can generate a lot of different content. And we don't, like, we use learning science to try, so we have some advisors that tell us, yeah, this looks like a good interaction. This is something I make. But it's a way to kind of create priors for the AI, you know, to tell them this sounds like, but then we want to learn. We want to learn what keeps people engaged, what keeps people coming back, what makes people progress, how much adaptation you need for one person to the other, how fast should you go, what themes should you use. So there's this whole world of, like, you know, all possible ways of learning. I think there's a little bit of science, but it could be great to learn, like, the same way like TikTok learns about you really quickly, like, hey, what keeps you coming back? Can we do the same thing for learning? So I don't have a prior conviction as to what it's going to take, but I do know with Gen AI, we can generate a lot more content than was possible in the past, try a lot more things, obviously still informed by the science that exists out there, but then learn what works best and what we need to improve, you know?
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. Mr. Pesante, the next question is not from me, but it's from Guilherme Silveira, who unfortunately could not be here, but he sent a question to you, and I'm just going to paraphrase it. So basically, when ChatGPT came out, Bill Gates and some other people came out saying that education now is going to be equal for everyone, right? And that now everyone's going to have the access to a good tutor. And, well, since 2022 until now, it's not exactly what we've been seeing. It is available for people online, people who have a computer, but tools like GPT-4, Claude 3, Opus, like the state-of-the-art models, they are expensive. Like, you have to pay a $20 fee or something like this, which is not really practical in countries for, like, Brazil, for example, or countries that rely too much on public education. Of course, these are positive tools, but the question that Guilherme was asking is, if these tools, like the way that they are being available right now, they are just continuing this process of contributing to inequality in these countries, meaning the rich can afford them, they're going to get a better education. The normal classes and the poor are not going to be able to get this knowledge from this. So in your company, Sizzle, how do you think about dealing with this issue of inequality so that this thing of education available for everyone will not remain just like a false promise?
All right. So first, I'd say that if there's one problem in the world I'd like to solve, it's this one. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, it's not because you want to solve it, you're going to solve it. So again, I think everybody needs to be a little modest. And I think Bill Gates, when saying this, you know, like 20 years ago, when, you know, the internet was full swing, when the MOOCs, you know, like the massive open online courses came out, everybody said the same thing, right? And, you know, today in Brazil, you can take Stanford courses, you can take MIT courses. Doesn't mean you're going to take them because they're not optimal for you. It's not that easy. So it's going to change education. Yeah, big word. And it's not that ChatGPT is going to change education. You can't learn, you know, like you can get answers, but it's not learning, right? So I think we all need to take a deep breath, and it's going to take a while. This is what we want to do with Sizzle, but to really change, you know, and give broader access. In terms of the cost of the model, again, GPT itself is not going to be what's going to solve this. It's a tool. And my hope there is, yes, they are expensive, but luckily things are getting cheaper and cheaper. So today you can actually go to my former team, right? You know, on WhatsApp, you can use Meta AI. It's using Llama 3. It's not quite GPT-4, but it's not that far either, right? And in just a year, it's pretty close to what GPT-4 was a year and a half ago. So, you know, in the grand scheme of things, being like a year late or a year and a half late, I wouldn't call that amazing discrepancy between like someone that, you know, is poor condition in Brazil and someone that lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts, you know, and going to Harvard, you know, like that. So, you know, if they can get the Harvard of language model in a year and a half, I think we'll be good, you know, like. So I'm not too worried about this. I think what I'm more worried about is, like, it's not because you're going to get access to GPT or GPT-4 that you're going to learn. You know, this is the problem. Access is not enough, right? You need to create a compelling way for people who come from all parts of the world to learn in an effective way. That's what I want to solve. Learn in their own language. You know, have really good resources there, have a compelling experience, right? Not just something available, because that's the problem. It's not because it's available, you're going to do it. Have something that understands you, that see what drives you, right? Maybe you want to create like a mass curriculum that talks about soccer, you know, like, and that would get the kids to do that. So that's what I'm worried about. You know, how it's not just about giving access, it's making it in a way that's going to make people learn, right? And often, like, if you just build products for like the top 1% of the world, that's not going to happen, right? Other people, again, you have access to in the Stanford course. I guarantee the kids from Brazil are not going to use it. You know, it's not adapted to them. It's not going to work for them.
And still talking about this question, is it your goal for Sizzle to be applied in classrooms as well in the future? Or is it more something that kids should do at home?
Yeah, we're all thinking of something complementary. Again, we're not trying to change all learning. And we'd like to be a complement to school, you know. And I think school, I think what's really interesting is this in-person. And I think there's things you can do in-person that you'll never be able to do through an app or an iPad. What we'd like to do is to unload a lot of the stuff that the teacher has to do in the classroom online so that they have more time to do the real things you can do, like more collaboration, more group learning, more, you know, one-on-one FaceTime, right? And us, maybe we can do more like the basic, like give you the material you need to figure out, give you the exercise that are the best you can find next, you know, give you the practice, grade you, give you feedback, you know, one-on-one, which you can't do as a teacher. But we'd love to kind of like offload a lot of the tedious tasks from the teacher. We're not going to replace school.
Right. And one of the many advantages that often come up when we talk about Gen AI is how much faster it can get you to the desired result, right? It helps you code faster, it helps you write or at least edit faster, and so on. Do you think that this might apply to learning as well? Do you see a future in which the current 10, 15-year-long school curriculum could be condensed into a fewer years, or maybe keep those 10, 15 years, but squish even more knowledge into those? How does it work?
Yeah, I agree. I think we haven't cracked that nut yet, but I think this is what we want to do. I do believe that Gen AI can help people learn a lot more effectively. And I think one of the reasons is that you can generate the next piece of learning content that's exactly what you need next. You know, you don't need to, like, it can be extremely adapted to you, right? It can answer your question that you have at the moment. It can give you the practice you need to do there. Like, you can generate it on the fly as needed. I think that's a really big power that we could put in that to make the learning process a lot more effective. What's also interesting is I think people will learn to do things with Gen AI, which is You know, one thing I mentioned to people, which is like, when I recruit engineers right now in my company, I ask them to use, you know, Copilot and GPT-4 as they are doing the interview, because this is the job today, right? You're not going to code without it. If you're a good coder today, you should use GPT-4. There's no question about it. It doesn't replace you, believe me. Like, it doesn't, it's millions of years away from, I mean, maybe not millions, but it's definitely like decades away from replacing a very talented software engineer. But it does some tasks that, you know, were tedious before, and you do it much faster. So you need to use that. So we also need, this is what's interesting about, you know, skills, that skills evolve every day. And the skills you learn need to move every day. And that's why I think more having more dynamic learning tools can help you do that compared to like fixed curriculums.
Right. And how did AI help you get Sizzle up and running? How did you use AI to actually get the company off the ground?
Oh, but for us, I mean, two ways, right? I mentioned one is that because it powers some of the basic experiences we provide to user, right? So today, when we help the students solve a problem or we give them practice problem, all of that is generated by AI. So the engine behind what we do is a lot of the, you know, traditional AI plus Gen AI. Right? The second is that our developers, I mean, including myself, you know, I code as well, we use Gen AI all the time. And it does make us, you know, I would say at least 10, 15, 20% more effective. For some jobs, like writing reports, for example, like doing a lot of data science, it's amazing, you know, how much faster it is to do that. Like literally like a multiplier. For other jobs, like engineering a complex system, it doesn't really help you, you know.
And does your team consist more of pedagogy experts or people that can relate to data and use it, like data scientists, machine learning engineers, and researchers?
And my team is more of a, which is a traditional software team. It's people who do engineering, and including AI and ML, and then people who have more of a product sense, you know, design, user research. And then I have advisors who advise us on the learning science so that the choice we make are always informed by the learning science. But I actually don't have educators as part of the staff right now.
And what are the current limitations that you're facing on personalized tutoring that you hope or maybe can see that will be overcome in the near future?
Yeah, I would say the limitation one is what you mentioned, right? The system makes mistakes, and so you need to compensate for that. And it's, there are a lot of things you can do. It's not just it makes mistakes. You can also get it to fix the mistake or throw away things where you have doubts. So it's not just, oh, it makes a mistake, I need to just show the mistake to the user. There are a lot of things you can do. So the next thing, because you can correct these mistakes, is, you know, latency and cost. So if one of these things could go down a lot, or two of these things could go down a lot, you could solve a lot of problems. So right now we're trying to do it. Like if even if you made a mistake, but if you had latency is very low and cost is very low, then you can throw away a lot of the mistakes and correct them on the fly and not have a lot of mistakes. When all three are high, it's a lot harder. If it makes a mistake and high latency and it's costly, then you're more constrained. So we're playing with all this, you know, like and using different models, I can do different things at different times. But it's getting better by the day, so we can do more, you know, with these models as we go.
Right. We had a conversation with Stephen Wolfram recently, and he said that the best tool to correct AI mistakes is the actual AI. So having it run again and again and again, the AI will correct itself and eventually...
Yes, actually, we do. Or sometimes, actually, even another tool. I mean, he's modest, but I don't know that Stephen is modest. But I talked to him, actually, 3 weeks ago. We were at a conference together. And combining, actually, language model and Wolfram Alpha is also something that's promising as well. Because language models, actually, are not very good for calculations, you know. And so he created, like, a major... Like, you can think of it as a knowledge calculation machine. I think combining Wolfram and language models could be the best of both worlds. You know?
Definitely.
But it's also costly, and it's not that simple. And, you know, there are a lot of things still to figure out there.
And Mr. Pesenti, for you who are in the middle of this AI hurricane, I want to do a little futurology experiment, the same one that everyone's been doing all around the world. But I want to know your opinion about it. Will we get to AGI, and when?
First, you know, you have to define AGI, so I'm not a big believer, you know, I don't like that term. So I think what we're talking about is, will it get to like human level performance in all tasks? I don't think I'll see it in my lifetime, you know, that's my bet. Because what happens is that it's amazing, as I mentioned, you know, we started this discussion, I say like the progress it's making feel more and more amazing. But as you make progress, you also realize how much further the goal line is. I think every time we make progress in AI, we realize intelligence is much deeper than it is. It's interesting to, I mean, I use GPT every day right now, right? For every GPT-4. And it's amazing how silly it is, you know? And these problems are not that easy to solve. And I don't buy, I mean, I do buy that it's going to get better, But I'm not seeing the breakthroughs, you know, that will really get us to solve that anytime soon. I think there's just it's a statistical machine, you know. It makes this fundamental problem that, you know, it understands something very statistically, but ultimately it misses some core aspect that, you know, frankly, it doesn't have, you know, common sense, right? And I don't think scaling it up will solve that. I mean, you know, that's been when you scale up, it does get things that feel really, you know, a lot smarter. But there seems to be some fundamental limitation. So my get is that, yes, it will get better. We'll still get progress. But every time we make progress, we realize human intelligence is much further away. You know, I have a little anecdote for you. And I went to visit like this cloud lab. You know, I ran a company before I did AI for drug discovery. And what's very exciting these days is you have these AI-powered cloud labs, you know, so you can do experiments. But you go to the lab and here's what it looks like. You have 70 machines in a warehouse. And each of these machines have like this advanced thing that can replace a white coat job. You know, they can replace like someone doing this very precise experiment. But bringing one sample from one machine to the other or cleaning up the machine, no way you can do that today, right? And so the white coat jobs have been replaced, but the blue collar jobs are infinitely far away from being, and they have no intention and no way of doing this because it's way too complicated, you know, like cleaning this complex machine, bringing sample from one of them, dealing with all these different machines in different ways. Like, so it's funny, like we just have sometimes misconceptions about what intelligence is, you know, like running a very precise experiment that you used to need to have like a lab person do, you know, maybe that we can do, you know, connecting all these pieces, having robots that, you know, that can clean something or fold or do your dishes, you know, it's way, 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 way harder, you know.
Right. And still on the looking ahead issue, what sorts of things have been exciting you when it comes to the AI or actually Gen AI market? Education, of course, I imagine plays a big part in that. But what have you been paying attention to that maybe people aren't really paying attention to that you'd say, you know, keep an eye on such and such?
Well, the first thing I'd say is that there's a lot of buzz. And then people need to look back as what has AI done for you in your life? Okay. And I think if you look back today in the day, like you have 24 hours, like you use your phone for hours, right? You use the internet maybe for hours. But AI, actually, you don't know it. AI was there because it sold you products through ads and it was in Instagram, you know, like when you were on it and you didn't know it. But actually, true AI that you experience, like a robot you interact with or something that drove your car, not so much. And you may have used GPT, some people do it, but most people actually today, majority of the world does not use GPT, right? So at the end of the day, you didn't experience that much AI. So I think I would say the first thing is like, take a cool head there. What has AI done for you today? Most likely nothing, okay? Nothing that you can mention. So I think we shouldn't be all very modest and stuff. That's what excites me first. Like, what is AI going to really do in your life that's going to make it better, you know? As Fabricio in Brazil today, and then like, what is it going to do for your life to make it a much better life? So let's all be modest. It's not doing much right now. So what I'm working on, obviously, is I think learning is one of them. I do think another one people have talked about is health. And the challenge there, again, is like, we know there is good technology there. We know we can do things, but adopting it, the cultural challenges for that are still pretty far away, right? Can you free the doctor from the diagnostic and getting them to spend more time with the patient? You know, it's a bit the same thing with learning. I think there is an opportunity there. I think machines could become much better at diagnostic. Doctors should become much better at the human understanding, right? I actually say sometimes we're going to maybe replace the doctor. We won't replace the nurse, you know, like, and so again, understanding what is really fundamental for human and freeing the human from things that machines can do is exciting. I think in science is going to be interesting. Like how you do science, you know, like crunching up numbers, you know, like interacting with the real world data. I think the scientists, I think in 10 years, will all have AI system to do their science, you know. But I think we should all be modest because today hasn't done much for us, you know.
Okay, so last question. Many of our listeners are actually development students, are interested in becoming developers, in working. Many of them actually are trying to figure out a way to get into working with AI. What would you recommend they spend their time on? They learn which tools, which knowledge should they get to get into the market?
I mean, now has never been a better time to, you know, do things on your own, do your own projects, you know, try to leverage the technology, you know, like you can build things on top of these APIs. You can try them. coding is one of these things where you learn, I mean, a lot more actually from practicing it than going to school. School can help, you know, there's things. My son, my oldest, you know, he's studying software engineering, but he's also doing a lot of things on his own, you know. And I think he built like, you know, he built a poker boat on top of GPT, you know, he did it on his own, you know, like. So I would really encourage, this is the way you learn to code, is doing by practicing, and then use the resources online to learn new things. And, you know, get yourself a level. So this is the nice opportunities. You know, actually coding is one of the things that you can learn better on your own than at school. So don't wait for school to give it to you. You know, take the initiative and build stuff. You know, you learn by building. Try things, take some modest project, make them more and more complex, you know, as you go.
Perfect. Mr. Pezzenti, thank you very much for your time, for sharing your knowledge with us. If folks want to keep up with what you were working on actually on the company as well, how should they do that?
That's a good question. I'm kind of like a little bit, you know, out of social media. They can follow the company on social media, you know, like personally, I'm taking a bit of a break. So I'm trying to build things.
Right.
But, you know, just follow us in all, you know, and download the app.
Perfect. The links will be in the description. Thank you very much once again. E para você que quer seguir se atualizando, se aprofundar, não só na área de, talvez, contribuir para a área de inteligência artificial na educação, mas para tudo o resto, não faltam cursos e formações na Alura para você fazer isso, mas vamos aproveitar esse finalzinho do episódio de hoje para reforçar o recado que a gente deu na semana passada sobre a IA Conference Brasil 2024, que se você já perdeu uma semana para garantir seu ingresso, corre, passa na descrição, garante antes que entre já o segundo lote, fica um pouquinho mais caro. E, bom, isso aqui também é uma criança quase aqui do Fabrício. Fala para a galera sobre a IA Conference Brasil 2024, Fabrício.
Com certeza, vai ser a maior conferência de tecnologia de IA, na verdade, desse ano aqui no Brasil, provavelmente. E a gente está começando, Marcos, a liberar finalmente os nomes de alguns dos participantes, dos palestrantes lá. Então, se você entrar hoje em iaconferencebrasil.com.br, você vai ver que já está lá liberado a Ana Paula Appel, ou Apple, da IBM, que ela, a gente já entrevistou ela aqui, né, falando sobre computação quântica e IA. Também o Alexandre Chiavegato Filho, que é professor de Machine Learning na área de saúde na USP. E também o Jomar Silva, da NVIDIA, né, uma empresa que a gente fala bastante aqui, principalmente nesses últimos tempos. E eu vou dar um mini spoiler só para quem está ouvindo aqui hoje. Eu acho que o pessoal não me autorizou para isso, Marcos, mas a quarta palestrante, que o nome vai ser liberado muitíssimo em breve, o nome dela começa com a letra M e o sobrenome começa com a letra L. Então, quem está aí no mundo de IA, talvez já tenha pegado, se não pegou, tá, fica no ar aí.
Vamos entrevistar a Machine Learning, então, é isso?
Exato.
Muito bem. Então, pessoal, não percam essa chance. Vai ser um evento muito interessante e importante para vocês. Olha, em 21 de agosto, em São Paulo. Passa na descrição, pega o link, garante o seu ingresso. E a gente se vê por lá. E na semana que vem tem mais. Hipsters, abraços. Tchau.
Este podcast foi produzido pela Alura. Mergulhe em tecnologia. E Faculdade FIAP. Let's Rock the Future. Edição Rede Gigahertz de Podcasts.